Well, good morning, everyone. Judge Sykes and I are pleased to be joined this morning by United States District Court Judge Sam Duryagian, who is sitting by designation on all six cases that we're going to hear today. I believe he's also sitting tomorrow. So we're going to overload Judge Duryagian with a lot of appeals in the next couple of days. Our first case this morning is the state of Terry G. versus Judy Johnson et al., appeal number 09-1895, and Mr. Stevenson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel James Stevenson, Counsel for Appellants Judy Johnson and James Edwards. My contention here today, Your Honors, is that the District Court erred by not affording qualified immunity to correctional officers who relied upon and followed directives of medical staff at a county jail. The District Court concluded that the decedent G was obviously ill and that Captain Johnson should have, in essence, overruled the decision of a nurse and an adult nurse practitioner with whom the nurse was consulting while treating G and sent him to the hospital. As to Sergeant Edwards, the District Court apparently concluded that Edwards should have sent G to the emergency room, despite the fact that all Edwards knew was that G was in an observation cell. He was lying down. He read a shift memo about why G was placed in the cell. And then he followed the directive of the nurse practitioner when she came on duty to transport him to the hospital. He carried out what he was told to do.
Do you think the medical defendants were deliberately indifferent?
I think some of them may have been negligent, Your Honor.
You don't think they were deliberate?
Well, I'm not representing them, obviously, but I.
Well, you're saying you relied on what they told you. You relied on their expertise.
Yes, my clients had a very brief, and it's important to recognize their encounters with G were of limited duration and only when G was under treatment by medical staff. It's not as though they had days and days to observe what treatment he was or wasn't getting. So when Johnson comes off an elevator, gets a call to come to a block where a nurse has already determined that she wants G transferred to an observation cell.
Let me ask you this. I would think this is a fairly... it's not a real serious charge that he's in the jail for, is it? It's a theft case or something. If he's as ill as he appears to be here, why keep him in the jail?
Well, I mean, in retrospect, you know, why keep him in the jail at all as opposed to sending him to the hospital?
Yeah,
in retrospect, that's would have been the better choice, of course.
Or go to court and have him released so that he could take care of himself. In the jail, he can't take care of himself. You have an obligation to take care of him when he's there.
As far as releasing him, that would require a court order.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But, I mean, there are a lot of inmates in county jails on lesser charges than theft. That's simply the way business is run. As far as not sending him to the hospital, you could perhaps fault the nurses and the adult nurse practitioner for not doing that, but how can you fault the correctional officers for encountering a circumstance where the nurse says, well, I've been in consultation with the nurse practitioner, we've been treating him, put him in an observation cell, nurses will see him starting at 4 a.m., the adult nurse practitioner will come in at 7 and she'll assess him at that time. This was a qualified immunity appeal, so what the district court did was rely upon what he refers to as sort of an unusual case exception. The general rule is that correctional officers may rely upon determinations by medical staff and should. In fact, the law is that if they don't, they may be deliberately indifferent if they disregard directives from medical staff. The court seemed to think, well, this may be an unusual circumstance because the guy needed immediate treatment, and there were inmates saying he needs to go to the hospital and what have you, and that if lay persons say he needs to go to the hospital, then you should you correctional officers should come to the same determination. This exception to the general rule, in my view, Your Honors, exists only in cases where treatment is not being provided at all. In other words, a jail officer comes upon a situation and it's apparent that no treatment is being provided, or that the treatment is so obviously inappropriate. So, and this is just a theoretical example. If an inmate is on the floor in convulsions or bleeding from the mouth, and the nurse says, well, give him an aspirin, well, that's not the kind of treatment that I think a jail officer may rightfully rely upon. That's not even treatment at all.
We have to take these facts as they're really alleged here, in light most favorable to the plaintiff. And
right.
It looks like this guy was really in a deteriorating condition, getting worse every day he was in the jail.
Well, he may have been getting worse every day, but my clients just had a... And this is very important. My clients had an encounter, Johnson had an encounter, which was perhaps an hour's duration at the end of a shift, where a nurse simply told her, I've been treating the guy, he needs to go into an observation cell. Edwards comes on duty at 11:45, okay? All he knows is that there's an inmate in a medical observation cell, there's a shift memo that says he's not been eating, he's not getting fluid intake and what have you. He sees him lying down. If he knew the nurse came on at 4 a.m., that's not in the record. We know the nurse did come on at 4 a.m. and saw him repeatedly. And then at 7:15, the adult nurse practitioner comes in and is assessing him and tells him this guy needs to go to the hospital for pneumonia evaluation. She doesn't say call an ambulance. She doesn't say it's an emergency. He does what she says. He fulfilled, both these officers fulfilled what medical staff told them to do. So how could they possibly be deliberately indifferent? And I'm not questioning, and I can't, on a qualified immunity appeal, the determinations of the court. We accept those determinations. What I'm telling you is, based upon those factual determinations by the district court, these officers were entitled to qualified immunity, and the court misapplied the law or didn't apply it properly.
You're into your rebuttal, and you've saved some time, as has your co-counsel here. So
I will save the balance of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Pellick.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Mary Ann Pellick. I am here on behalf of Bloomington Hospital and all individual medical defendants in this matter. We are here appealing the denial of the district court's our entitlement to qualified immunity by the district court. We accept the facts as found by the district court, but we believe that the court erred in applying those facts to the standard in this case. What the court should have applied, the standard they should have applied, was a subjective standard to whether or not the nurses were deliberately indifferent. Instead, what the court applied was more of a subjective standard, a reasonable man standard, what the nurses should have seen and what they should have done based on that, rather than what they actually saw and what they actually knew.
Would you first address the threshold question about whether you're entitled to claim qualified immunity in the first place?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be happy to. The issue as to whether or not we are entitled to qualified immunity to begin with was raised by this court with regard to the Bloomington Hospital itself and its memorandum of April 30th. It was also raised by the estate as to all medical defendants in their brief. As we indicated in our brief, we believe that this court does not need to decide that issue, but that issue was waived by the estate and the court below. We properly claimed the defense on behalf of all medical defendants in our brief. The estate in their brief and the court below did not address whether or not we were entitled to qualified immunity. Their entire brief was dedicated to whether or not we violated, whether or not we were deliberately indifferent whether or not there was a constitutional violation. There was one line in their brief that noted that it was an issue. They did not even object to whether or not we could raise qualified immunity. And the district court did the same thing. There wasn't an evaluation of the Richardson factors. There's not a sufficient record below for the court to go through that determination of whether or not we are entitled to qualified immunity.
But is that a jurisdictional question that we have to answer or can answer on our own without it having been raised in the district court?
I believe it is, and I believe the precedent in this court with the Sane versus Wood case last year indicates that it was, in fact, forfeited below, and you do not need to raise that issue. You do not need to decide that issue. This court, just last year in 2008, found that when the issue was not raised below, when the record was silent as far as facts necessary for this court to make that evaluation, the issue is waived, and the court does not need to make that determination. So we believe that we are entitled to qualified immunity. Assuming that we are entitled to qualified immunity, I would like to address the issue before this court. What the state had to show was that we violated the Constitution by showing deliberate indifference to the care of Terry G., and also that the right was clearly established at the time.
I'm sorry, you're not going to address Richardson at all, then?
I can. I believe that if the court does...
I think you should. I mean, it was raised below, and the fact that the district courts decided not to address it and went right to the merits of the qualified immunity defense doesn't mean that we shouldn't address it. It was raised, and the appropriate case law was cited, and so you know the burden was on you to defend against that issue, and I don't know the extent to which you did or didn't in the district court, but the fact that the district court skipped over it doesn't mean that we should.
All right. I believe pursuant to the facts of the Richardson case, first of all, looking at the Richardson case, that was a very narrowly decided case. They indicated that the decision was limited to the facts of that case with regard to prison guards.
Is there any material distinction between Richardson and the facts of this case?
There are. Most definitely, I think the most obvious one goes to the profit motive. If you look at Richardson and the cases that have looked at Richardson since its decision in 1997, one of the main factors that the court looks at is the private contractors wanting to make profit, to maximize their profits. What the estate notes in their brief in this case is that because they are for-profit entities, these contractors, they have the temptation to skimp on civil rights at the expense in order to maximize those profits. In this case, the Bloomington Hospital is a not-for-profit hospital. They don't have the incentive to want to skimp on civil rights in order to maximize profits. They don't have the ability to pay these big compensation packages, which is what that case looked at as far as in order to entice qualified employees to come to work on contracts like this with the government.
Is there competitive bidding for this contract to provide medical services at the jail?
There is no evidence in the record that there is, Your Honor, and I submit there is not.
Well, isn't that a matter of statute? I mean, most public contracting is governed by statute and regulation, so the fact that it's not in the record isn't an answer to the question.
I do not believe that there is, no.
Okay.
I also, one difference between Richardson and this case, in Richardson, the private contractor in that case was required under statute to provide insurance for civil rights types of claims. In this type of situation, there is no evidence that Bloomington Hospital provided that type of insurance for its employees. In fact, if you look at the jail medical services agreement that was signed between the hospital and the jail in this case, what the hospital is obligated to maintain is just general and professional liability insurance, medical malpractice insurance, what we're looking at in the state court, which is where this case belongs, not in the federal court. The hospital in this case, there's no evidence that it provided the type of insurance that would insulate the employees in this matter from these types of suits. And that supports our request for qualified immunity. In order to attract qualified candidates to partake of these types of jobs, to participate in these types of contracts, we need to be able to protect the employees. And they're not going to take these kinds of jobs if there's not some type of protection, which there isn't in this case. Does that answer the question as far as Richardson? Thank you. With regard to whether or not the hospital was deliberately indifferent in this case, again, as I indicated, we accept the facts as they were found by the district court, and we believe that they clearly show that the employees of the hospital were not deliberately indifferent, nor was the hospital. And I see that my time is up. I will save the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Valenti.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Victor Valenti on behalf of the estate. First, with respect to the jurisdictional question, It is our position that there, the medical defendants, the hospital, and the nurses are not entitled to qualified immunity or to an interlocutory challenge here. And we think that this is really a perfect example of this obvious temptation to skimp on civil rights, and that these are simply private parties acting pursuant to contractual duties, and they can't bring interlocutory appeals. In a somewhat different context, this court did so indicate in a case called Malinowski versus DeLuca in 1999. It's 177 F 3rd 623. In that case, employees of a private property inspection agency performed government inspections, and this court held that they were not entitled to governmental immunity under those circumstances. So we believe that certainly the hospital, which really, if one looks closely at the briefs in the district court, there really was no separate argument as to the hospital, and the judge did look at this, but then he simply denied their request for qualified immunity. With respect to the individual medical defendants, I think we get the same situation. And I think the best case, the case that's most on point, is actually the case from last year out of the Sixth Circuit, where this Harrison versus Ash case, nurses employed by private medical provider at a county jail were not entitled to assert qualified immunity, and the Sixth Circuit decided that it was without jurisdiction to consider this non-final order. And essentially, we're asking this court, I know that the court did look at this in the same case a year or two ago, but decided that they would not address the issue. They thought it was not preserved. Here, I think it does go to the court's jurisdiction, and I would suggest that the court should reach and squarely address that issue this time around.
Counsel, you said district court denied qualified immunity to medical defendants?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear
you. You said that district court denied qualified immunity to medical defendants?
Yes, that's correct.
Didn't the district court reserve judgment on that issue?
Well,
the court did not explicitly resolve this issue.
The court did not explicitly resolve the issue. I would suggest that at least by comparison, in looking at how that the Harrison versus Ash case was handled by the Sixth Circuit, this issue seems to be certainly as well preserved in this issue before this court. Plus, as I say, I think it's a matter of jurisdiction, and it's the kind of issue that I think this court is obliged to actually consider and determine when it comes to an issue of its own jurisdiction. With respect to the court's denial of the qualified immunity on the merits, the district judge said if the estate's witnesses are believed, a jury could find, in particular with the medical defendants, Johnson and Edwards, that they turned a blind eye to G's condition and improperly deferred to the medical staff. This was clearly an obvious condition, there were obvious medical needs here. This isn't the kind of question where there's some sort of medical judgment involved, which is what the sheriff's defendants seem to be trying to state. There were various lay persons. Mr. G's cellmate, Stanislaw, his friend Turpin, his mother, all recognized that he needed immediate medical care beyond whatever was being administered at the jail.
Did he have a lawyer when he was in this jail?
I don't know the answer to that question. My trial counsel is shaking his head, but I honestly don't know. I've seen nothing in the record to indicate that he had counsel.
Have you had his probable cause hearing? Was this a warrantless arrest, I assume?
Yeah. Again, I'm relying on my trial counsel. I truly, it wasn't a fact that I noted anywhere in the record. So
he was just unable to make bail, apparently.
Presumably that was it. I mean, he obviously, Mr. G was obviously someone who'd been there before, and that's a big part of this, is that they were so well aware of his diabetic and schizophrenic condition coming in, and this is not just the medical staff. This was Johnson and Edwards as well. They essentially all admitted that they were aware. I'm told that it was a theft and a probation violation, and he had a hold. Counsel for the jailers indicated that Mr. Edwards only had Officer Edwards only had this minimal contact, but in fact, he wanted to focus on the minimal contact on the morning of the 31st when nurse practitioner Rogers actually did finally convey him. We would say at least 2 days late, but the fact of the matter is that Edwards had earlier contact with LPN Anderson at 4 a.m. on the 29th, and in fact, nurse practitioner Rogers says in hindsight we should have conveyed him at that time. So Edwards is not just doing his job. Both of these jail officials agree that if they are to also use their own judgment, they're not abdicating all of their judgment to the medical staff in a situation like this. And at the time on the 29th, Edwards, that was the time when Mr. G was apparently walking around in circles, but then denying that he was even moving, and then he fell to the floor. They had to put him back up on the bed. His legs were shaking uncontrollably. So Edwards' contacts with Mr. G are not as minimal as the jail defendants would like to state.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the difference between Commander Wilson and the two officers, Edwards and Johnson, when the district court said in its opinion that it is well established that a jail officer is entitled to defer to the judgment of a medical professional with regard to the appropriate way to treat an inmate? And dismissed your contentions against Wilson.
We don't generally contest the statement that the district judge's statement in that regard, but Wilson's contact with, and I'm going back, I didn't even consider Wilson because he was gone at the time that I did this brief, but my recollection it was Wilson's contact in this case was far less than either. It was essentially based on his title as commander. I don't believe that there was any or very little personal contact at all with Mr. G, where they were actually, where he actually, I don't know that he ever went to the to Mr. G's cell. So I think that's the distinction, and I think the important distinction that the district judge recognized is the fact that that this is the kind of situation where it was obvious, and in the court's words, he turned a blind eye, as did Johnson. So I don't know. I mean, I will simply refer to my rely on my brief in with respect to the argument that that indeed both defendants and both attorneys for defendants in this case are have delved deep into the facts on this, and I'm not even I'm pretty convinced that there isn't really an argument at law here beyond saying that you know, no, they're trying to say this is simple medical malpractice. I heard it again this morning. This is simple malpractice instead of deliberate indifference. But I think the case law is clear that this is the kind of situation that cries out to be deliberate indifference. And I would, I guess I have time left, so if the court has any further questions, but I think this is this was somebody who obviously needed medical care, and this is an obvious case of deliberate indifference that the jury needs to hear.
Well, you'd have to concede that the case with respect to the two corrections officers is harder for you on deliberate indifference, given their less substantial contact with.
I think that's in fact true. Although I think that this case does present a very strong case for deliberate indifference, even for those two officers. I don't think that as a matter of law and kind of as a matter of policy as well that you want to give the jail officers a pass in a situation like this, where somebody has to stand up and say that this man needs to go to the emergency room, and in the circumstances here, I think it cries out for that as well. Thank you, Your Honors.
You both have a couple of minutes each.
First, I'd like to remark upon this. They keep coming back to this assertion that on March the 29th, that Officer Edwards was with Nurse Anderson when G was stepping in circles and what have you. The reality is the district court makes no mention of such an occurrence because there is no evidence that Officer Edwards was with the nurse at that time. In fact, there's a footnote in the district court's opinion which, in a sense, admonishes plaintiff for making statements without evidentiary support, and this is one of them. What are they relying upon? They're relying upon a log entry. There's no deposition testimony. A log entry that says that Officer Edwards made an entry at 4:13 a.m. when Nurse Anderson was on duty. And in fact, if the court looks at the court's determinations below, the district court describes this episode with Anderson and says nothing about Edwards being present. I want to talk in my remaining minutes, Your Honors, about the clearly established law component of this appeal. It is my and the plaintiff has come forward with no cases that I'm aware of which hold that a jail officer who fails to override a medical practitioner can be guilty of deliberate indifference. If we go back to 2002, we have Perkins versus Lawson, which defined the law in this circuit that, or at least reaffirmed the law in this circuit, that jail officers are entitled to rely upon medical staff determinations. In 2002, there was a district court opinion, Bond versus Aguinaldo, where the district court, at least in theory, accepted the proposition that an unusual case may arise where a jail officer may have to take action, but even in Bond, that didn't occur. Bond is then cited in 2006 in Johnson versus Doty. This, and that's important because this occurrence is from March of 2005. It's not until Johnson, that I'm aware of,
that we have even an assertion by the circuit court in the Seventh Circuit that there's an exception to the general rule. And in fact, there's no case cited in any of these briefs pre-March of 05 that would hold that it's clearly established otherwise. That's why we have qualified immunity. A jail officer confronted with this body of law under these facts would have to conclude that what I'm doing is lawful. Certainly, it isn't clearly established that what they're doing is unlawful. Hence, the district court erred in not affording qualified immunity. Now, the plaintiff does cite a case, ICO from the Fourth Circuit, decided in 2008. This was an instance where an inmate was maced. A nurse didn't do anything for the inmate. Jail officers argued on appeal, well, we relied on the nurse. Well, the nurse didn't do anything. A jail officer cannot rely upon the lack of treatment or determination by medical staff to not do anything. But that's not what occurred here. They knew that medical staff was dealing with G, so they were entitled to rely upon it. So in conclusion, Your Honors, I believe my officers did everything that was required by medical staff. And to expose them to Section 1983 liability here is simply clearly erroneous. And the district court should have recognized it as such. I think my time is concluded, and I thank you.
The estate cites two cases in support of its assertion that we are not entitled to jurisdiction, or the court should not accept jurisdiction of this case because we're not entitled to qualified immunity, the Malinowski case and the Harrison case. Both of those cases are distinguishable from the case at bar. First of all, the Harrison case is a Sixth Circuit case, of which this court is not bound by that ruling. But one of the reasons the courts have cited for allowing qualified immunity to private contractors is to preserve their ability to serve the public good. Bloomington Hospital, in this case, was doing just that. They were providing medical care to the inmates at the jail. They are different from the contractors that were considered in both the Malinowski and the Harrison cases. Those contractors were for-profit contractors. The hospital is not. There is no evidence in this case that the hospital has any ability to compensate for the risk that is incurred in accepting these types of cases. Because of that, we believe that we are entitled to assert the defense of qualified immunity in this case. With regard to deliberate indifference and whether or not a constitutional violation occurred, again, there is no evidence, looking at it in the light most favorable to the estate as found by the district court, that the nurses in this case were deliberately indifferent to the medical needs of Terry G. Looking at it in hindsight, looking at it through the objective standard, the reasonable man standard, maybe you can say, yes, they should have done more. That's what the estate's experts say, is they should have done more seeing this. Nobody is contesting that Terry G. was sick. We agree that Terry G. was sick. But where we disagree is that the nurses exhibited deliberate indifference. The nurses saw the same thing everybody else saw. They saw that he was ill, but they were treating him. They weren't just leaving him there. They saw him multiple times a day. They were providing him with insulin. They were checking his blood sugar. They were providing him with the medication that was brought in by his mother. The nurse practitioner saw him on the 28th, the first day he asked for treatment. She saw him that day. She saw him the next day. And that's in addition to the number of times that the other nurses were seeing him, providing the medication, checking the blood sugar. They were not conscious of a serious medical need and just ignoring it, which is what deliberate indifference is. If anything, you can argue now, looking back in hindsight, that yes, maybe they were negligent, maybe they should have tried a different type of treatment that they didn't, but they were not deliberately indifferent. They did not consciously disregard what was happening with Terry G. The estate in this case has also not provided the court with case law that clearly establishes that what the medical staff did in this case violated Terry G's constitutional rights. The cases that are cited by the estate are cases where it is clear that the medical staff in those cases knew something was wrong and just didn't do anything about it. The Sherrod case, in the notes, the medical notes in that case, the staff knows that there's a risk of appendicitis. Knowing there's that risk, they don't do the follow-up test. Here, we did not know that there was a risk of pneumonia that was happening and just didn't do anything about it. We were treating him with the symptoms that we saw as they came up. They were trying different medications. When the one didn't work, on the last day they started with the antibiotic. They were trying it. They were not deliberately indifferent, and none of the case law provided by the estate says otherwise. The other cases, thank you, I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.